Great to be with you. Thank you for your welcome. It's wonderful to be here. As you've already worked out, I've come all the way from Liverpool, which is a relatively quick trip. If only they'd build a road, for goodness sake, instead of having to go all the way around. But nonetheless, it's great to be here, and thank you again for your invitation. I'm just looking at a picture of myself there, which is very lovely. The picture's very good. It's very accurate, which actually means it's not very lovely. But it's great to be here. And I want to just read, it's been wonderful to hear that image this morning of the Good Shepherd, the sense of this image of Jesus and who he is. And that comes from the Gospel of John. And we read about that in John chapter 10. And the writer of that Gospel is very keen that we not only hear those profound truths about Jesus, and there are many of them in John's Gospel. There are so many ways in which Jesus is described. I am the Good Shepherd. I am the way, the truth, and the life. I am so many things. But not only that, but he shows us this by the way in which Jesus interacts with people and the way in which Jesus engages with the world around him. And it's one of those other stories from John's Gospel that I want us to look at for a few minutes this morning, where in many respects the life of Jesus and the actions of Jesus and the behavior of Jesus is underlining these truths about Jesus, one of which we have so profoundly celebrated in our worship this morning. And we find that in John chapter 4. And it's a story of a very ordinary encounter in the midst of the very ordinary life. I was fascinated by that question, what makes a good shepherd? And I think I would agree with all of the answers. I was intrigued by that comment that I love the smell of sheep. So do I, particularly when they've been in a moderate oven for about an hour and a half. particularly like that. And so that was good. But actually, you know, when you read the clever people, the people that read the Greek and such like, and the people that scrutinize the actual words, the purist, the kind of Bangor University head of theology kind of person would say, well, actually, the good that Jesus refers to there is not just when he's being a shepherd, but when he's not being a shepherd. The good is an all-encompassing good. In the way that, you know, we may look at some people and say, well, he's a good footballer, but, well, the good in that sense is not just he's a good everything, including being a shepherd. And, well, hold that in mind as we read the story of this encounter in John chapter 4. Now, we had to go through Samaria. John chapter 4, verse 4. Just in case, it isn't, by the way, a head of theology from Bangor University here, is there? No, that's good. We're just with hydrocarbons and stuff. That's cool. I know nothing about them, but I won't talk about them either. Now, had to go through Samaria, so we came to a town in Samaria called Sychar. Near the plot of ground, Jacob had given his son Joseph. And Jacob's well was there, and his son, and Jesus, tired as he was from the journey, sat down by the well, and it was about noon. And when a Samaritan woman came to draw water, Jesus said to her, "Will you give me a drink?" And his disciples had gone into the town to buy food. The Samaritan woman said to him, "You're a Jew, and I'm a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink?" For Jews do not associate with Samaritans. And Jesus answered, "If you knew the gift of God and who it was who has asked you for a drink, you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." "Sir," the woman said, "you've nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. Where are you going to get this living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us this well and drank from it himself? Gave us this well, as did his sons and his flocks and his herds." Herds, even. Jesus, I'm thinking about the sheep again in the oven. Jesus answered, "Everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again. But those who drink the water I give them will never thirst. Indeed, the water I give them will become a spring of water welling up to eternal life." The woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water, and I won't get thirsty and have to keep coming here to draw water." And Jesus said to her, "Call your husband and come back." I have no husband, she replied. And Jesus said to her, you're right when you say you have no husband. In fact, you've had five husbands, and the man you are with now is not your husband. What you have said is quite right. Sir, the woman said, I see you're a prophet. Our ancestors worshipped on this mountain, but you Jews, you claim that the place where we must worship is Jerusalem. Woman, Jesus replied, believe me, a time is coming when you will worship on the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. You Samaritans worship what you do not know. We worship what we do know, for salvation is from the Jews. Yet a time is coming and has now come when the true worshippers will worship the Father in the Spirit and in truth, for they are the kind of worshippers the Father seeks. God is Spirit, and his worshippers must worship him in Spirit and truth. The woman said, I know the Messiah, called Christ, is coming, and when he comes, he will explain everything to us. And then Jesus replied, I, the one speaking to you, I am he. And just then the disciples returned and were surprised to find him talking with a woman. But no one asked, what do you want? Or why are you talking with her? Then leaving her water jar, the woman went back into the town and said to the people, come see a man who told me everything I've ever done. Could this be the Messiah? And they came out of the town and made their way towards him. Meanwhile, the disciples urged him, Rabbi, eat something. This is the word of the Lord. Before we think about that for a few moments, I wonder if I may indulge you. As was said earlier, I'm part of the regional ministry team here in North Wales and the northwest of England, a team of people who are committed to supporting churches, supporting Baptist churches across this part of this nation and into England and Cheshire, Lancashire, and Merseyside and Greater Manchester. And it's a joy and a privilege to be able to sort of connect you, as it were, with that wider community. And I just want to, if I may, just ask you a question. How many of you this week have spent a fiver on something that you actually didn't really need? You know, maybe you bought a Costa's, or maybe you popped in somewhere and just seen a magazine. I must confess my own guilty pleasure. I was in Tesco's the other day. Sad as it is, I bought a copy of Railway Modeler. Sorry. There was just this beautiful Great Western layout. And I just had to have it. 1930. It just had to be had. Colour photographs. And a free Metcalfe low relief model to go with it as well. By the way, a Metcalfe model is not what some of you might be thinking. It's a house, just to be clear. But how many of you have done that? You know, just something, yeah, I didn't really need that, but you know, yeah, most of us do. And one of the challenges I just want to offer folk this year is actually, could you do the same to invest in mission? Could you actually spare a five or a month to just invest in the mission of churches in the Northwest and North Wales? And if you could, I brought somebody, I'm not going to give you the big long talk about all the things we're doing, because I've brought you a lovely jubbly little leaflet here, and there we go. And so I'm going to leave these, and I'm going to ask you to take one away and just read some of the stories of local churches like this one. We couldn't possibly fit them all in, but I'm going to leave them there. You can hand them out if you get bored in the sermon. You start reading them now, for all I care. That's great. And just invite you to take those. And if you want to, you can read about what we're doing, and I won't say any more about it for now, because we want to get to thinking about this story that we read about a few minutes ago, the story of the woman at the well of Samaria. Now, I don't know if you've ever watched one of those movies where basically the story is being told from the perspective of two different people. You know, you kind of, there's a scene here and there's a scene there and there's a scene here and there's a scene there. And at some point, these two narratives join up and you suddenly realize that actually you're looking at the same story but from two different places. Well, in some respects, that's what I want to try and invite you to do with this story of the Jesus and his interaction with the woman at the well. Because I want to suggest to you that actually, if you stop and think about it for a minute, there are two relationships going on. There are two interactions going on in this story. Now, one of them does take a little bit of exegetical imagination to recognize, and we have to fill in some of the gaps, but it's there. And the gospel writer is keen to point out to us and remind us that it's there. And that is the relationship between Jesus and his disciples. If you look at the text, you'll notice that every so often there is a little reference to the fact that the disciples are kind of part of this story. And the first occasion we discover that they've gone off into the town to buy food. They then come back from the town and they then engage Jesus in making sure that he's had his lunch. So the disciples are part of this story. And the thing that we know, I mean, John says at the end of his gospel, there are millions and millions and millions of stories, that's probably not quite how he puts it, about Jesus that I could tell you. There are so many stories about Jesus that you could fill an entire library with them. So the one thing we know is that John is not going to put stuff into his story if it doesn't need to be there. Because he's got enough to say. He's got a whole library full of stuff to draw on. So it's important to him to tell us the disciples are there. So on the one hand, here's Jesus in the middle of the story. On the one hand, there is this interaction between this woman from Sychar in Samaria. And on the other hand, there is this interaction between Jesus and his disciples. Why I want us to do that this morning is because I want to suggest to you that actually those two figures, the disciples and the woman, probably represent two ends of a spectrum into which every one of us could probably fit ourselves. The woman is a Samaritan. And we are told unequivocally by John that the Jews do not have anything to do with Samaritans. They are second-class citizens. They are less popular than Liverpool supporters in the Stretford End on a Sunday afternoon when Man United are playing Liverpool. Just to give you an assurance as to when the service will be over by. They were second-class. They were hated people. And not only that, but there are some significant questions, even amongst the Samaritan community, about this woman and her place in society, and her place in God's purposes. Because we're told that she has had a pretty unsuccessful string of relationships. We don't know why. We don't know all the ins and outs of it, but she's had five husbands. And now, I mean, to be fair, I think you've got to kind of give her the benefit of the doubt here. She's fed up with wedding cake. So she's kind of just stuck with a guy and they're not, which in that society, in that community, would have been utterly, utterly socially unacceptable. In fact, many of the clever people, the people with the PhDs and the Greek and all the rest of it, suggest to us that it is incredibly unusual for a woman in that community to go and draw water in the midday because it was hot. Wasn't a good time to be carrying heavy jars of water. And many suggest that the reason for that is because she was an outcast. And the people of the town would talk about her and be critical of her. So go at lunchtime when no one else is there. It's probably the best time to go. I don't know whether that's true. We don't know if it's true. But here is a woman who, to all intents and purposes, is completely out of it. Completely on the pale. Completely, in most people's eyes, nowhere near God's purposes, nowhere near belonging to God's people. And on the other end of the spectrum, we've got the disciples, the apostles, the in crowd, Jesus's top 12. These are people that throughout our history we have recognized as the pillars of the early church. Okay, Judas Iscariot, slight dubious situation going on there, but nonetheless, the disciples represent. They're the kind of regional ministers and ministers and deacons and elders. They're the people who really make the show happen. And that's why I say that if we kind of imagine that this morning, you know, if we were doing this as a kind of conference or something, I might say to you at this point, right now, come and stand in a line and put yourself where you think you belong in this spectrum. I won't do that because I know we'd all be here, obviously. But some of us might not. No, we may not be. But seriously, I hope that for a moment you can say, do you know, I belong in this story. I can be part of this story because I can fit myself in. I mean, at least I've come. So, you know, I'm not completely beyond the pale. At least I've turned up. I found my way to the church. And I want to look And the reason, too, is if we can put the first slide on, George, if that's possible, is because actually this story in John chapter 4 is something that I want to use this year, actually, across our churches in this Baptist community of ours, to think about this theme of love, hope, acceptance. And you might notice, you may have already seen this logo that we're using. And if you look just at those two hands that are, anyone know where that comes from? Anyone? No? I almost passed it this morning. If you have a look at the next, you'll see it actually is in the cloisters of Chester Cathedral. There we are. Those hands that you saw a moment ago are from this statue. And this is by the artist Stephen Broadbent. I don't know if any of you are familiar with Stephen Broadbent's work. Anybody know where the nearest Broadbent to here is? You? Oh, you are Stephen Broadbent. Well, congratulations on the operation. It's gone well. Okay, well, let's have a look at some of his work, see if you recognise any of Stephen's. Well, there he is making it. He sent me this picture. He made it a long time ago because none of that hair remains on his head, that is. But there you can see Stephen actually making the... And here's some of his other work, which if we can have a quick look at. You might recognise some of it if you've travelled around in these parts. Anyone recognise any of those? Yep. That. Do you know what that is? Anyone know what that is? Sorry?
Bird.
It's a bird. Do you know where it is? It's on the Birch turn off at Warrington on the M62. Do you know what it is? You're going to love it. It's a mobile phone mast. And he designed it in the days when, you know, people took massive protests and all the rest of it. So they said, let's put a Broadbent up. So, Steve, make us a statue that we can stick a mobile phone transmitter in without anybody knowing. And that's it. Isn't that lovely? Isn't he clever? But this is the nearest. Anyone know where this is? If we see the next one, George? It's not quite, it's actually in Rill, I'm told. It's in Rill. It's Drift. Drift Park, is that right?
It's on the promenade.
Yeah, thrilled. So that's his nearest. But Stephen, if we just can go back to the picture, Stephen has offered us this image of this story of Jesus, and this is his interpretation of the events that we've just read about a couple of minutes ago. And I want us to use this story to think together about the offer which Jesus makes, the offer which Jesus makes to this woman in the story when he says, you know, if you ask, I will give you a spring of spiritual water welling up within you unto eternal life. Did you know there's an Alpha course on here? Has that been advertised to you? It's quite funny because I went on the web this morning just to check what time the service was, make sure I left in time. And there's a countdown on the church website, you know. Never mind, so this morning, come to Alpha. That was good, good, good advertising. Well done. But you did also tell me when the service was, so that's helpful too. It said someone else was to speak. No, it didn't say someone else was to speak. But where was I? Yeah, that offer, that's what we want to encourage people. But I want to suggest to you too, that if we're going to be a people who say to others, we want you to know this story of love, hope, and acceptance that is Jesus, then we need to be a people who live that story too. And I want to suggest to you that in a gentle way, there are some interesting challenges for us when we contrast Jesus' interaction with this woman and the disciples' engagement in the story. And I want us to just stop and think, you know, in our sharing of the good news of Jesus, is there a danger that we can sometimes fall into the same traps that the disciples fell into in this story? So let's stop and think about what they are and think about what they may say to us about the mission of God in our world today. It seems to me that the first thing that the disciples got wrong was that they were busy trying to source what they believed Jesus needed. They were busy trying to get what they felt Jesus needed. They were busy organizing what they thought Jesus needed. They had gone into the town to find food. Now, that's a perfectly sensible thing to do. They recognized that it was a hot day, that it was a busy time, that there was a long journey ahead, and Jesus would need something to eat. And if we doubt for a minute how important they felt that was, it's the very first question they ask him when they get back. But the problem is they are so busy in the town organizing what they thought Jesus needed that they miss out on the fact that Jesus is engaging with someone with the good news of the gospel. That Jesus is beginning a process of transformation that is not only going to change this woman's life, but is going to have repercussions through the community in which she lives. Now, I doubt if any of us would say this morning that we would not love to see that happening in the city of Bangor. We would not love to see people engaging with the message of Jesus, meeting this good shepherd that we've spoken about, and for their encounter with the good shepherd to have the same ripple effect that we saw in that video earlier on in our service. But the challenge to us is, are we aware of what Jesus is doing? Are we aware of where Jesus is at work doing those things? And are we connecting with it? Or are we too busy organizing those things that we believe Jesus needs? You see, that's one of the dangers of church. And as I ask this question, I have to ask this question of myself. Because I make a living not only out of organizing church, but out of organizing church. That's how bad it is. And I think that's okay sometimes, as long as it doesn't take over. As long as we don't find ourselves at odds with what Jesus is doing. And so I just want to invite you to stop and think about your priorities this morning. Think about the stuff that you're doing. Think about where you're investing your energy. Think about what frustrates you and what delights you. And simply ask yourself the question, am I busy organizing what I think Jesus needs, or am I connecting with what Jesus is doing in my world and my community? And that leads us on to the kind of second mistake that it seems that the disciples then go on to make. Because having gone off to organize what Jesus, when they come back into the scene, they do that so typically Christian thing. They begin to debate. They begin to talk about people instead of talking to them. They're surprised. They're surprised to see Jesus talking to a Samaritan woman, because all their nice religious upbringing has told them that good Jews don't talk to Samaritan women. All their nice religious upbringing tells them that they're not our kind of people, and we don't really want those kind of people messing up our nice, tidy community here, because we are Jesus' in crowd. And then they end up doing that terrible thing. Instead of engaging with their community, they engage with one another to talk about their community. And dare I say, as someone who is often asked and invited to join with churches and journey alongside them and talk about mission, as one of those people who is constantly being invited to conferences, one of those people who sometimes is even invited to speak at those conferences, I think one of the big challenges that we face as a church today is we seem to spend more time talking about how to do mission than we actually spend talking about Jesus to the world around us. Sorry if that upsets you. Sorry if that's just kind of ruined that nice conference that you've just booked to go to. But I just want to challenge you, as someone who kind of sits on the edge and watches all this stuff going on, whether we've become a church today that is better at talking about mission than talking about Jesus in mission. I don't know. It's just a challenge I want to offer you as I invite you to think about how we are a community that proclaims the good news of Jesus. And that takes us on to the third problem that I would perceive in the relationship, because they then become confused. They then look at what Jesus is doing and they can't make sense. What is he doing that for? What's going on? We can't make sense of this. And so they become a very anxious and a very uneasy and a very defensive group of people, because they can't make sense of what Jesus is up to, because it doesn't fit with their preconditions and their expectations, because they've kind of come at the story in the wrong way. And so again, I just offer that because here's the funny thing. There are so many connections between the disciples and this woman. You know, there's the whole food and drink thing. You know, they go off into the town to find food and Jesus says, "Will you give me something to drink?" I didn't actually want food. I wanted a drink. And guess what? I'm sitting by a well. They go off into the town. The woman goes off into the town. The disciples bring back the contents of the town's grocery store. The woman brings back the inhabitants of the town to talk to Jesus. Which of the two is mission? So I invite you to reflect on those things for a few minutes this morning. But as I said to you, I want you to look at this story from two angles because I've kind of focused a lot on the disciples. And I've done that because I sense that most of us would kind of be the busy, the activists, the people who are keen. The people would come to church even when it might snow while we're there. Just to worry you. It hasn't snowed yet and there's none up north. But you know, there is this woman. At the other end of the spectrum, there is this woman. And she's a woman who really has had a pretty raw deal in life. She's a woman that society has told again and again and again, she's not good enough, she don't fit. She's not worth God's attention. It's the narrative of the community in which she lives. But Jesus makes her the absolute centre. I don't know what you think when you look at that particular image and that particular logo. But I suggest, I don't know, because I don't know how you've engaged with it, but I would suggest to you that when you first saw those two hands on the side of the love, hope, acceptance, you probably imagined that in some way or other they were your hands, or they were the hands of someone in our community that we would want to receive the message. But if you look at the statue, you'll notice that they're Jesus' hands. It's Jesus who engages with this woman, not by saying, "What can I give to you?" but "What can you give to me?" And I want to suggest to you that no matter how worthless you might feel, no matter how much of a mess you might think you have made of your life, no matter how many narratives of failure and rejection and prejudice you have had to live with, Jesus comes to you with open hands. And he says, "I think you're good enough to have something to offer. I think you're good enough for me to receive you into my kingdom." But of course, if you look at the statue, the theological bit is the bottom, isn't it? Because her life and her being springs from this "I am" Jesus, who is not just the good shepherd or the way, the truth, the life or the door or all the other things that he says. "I am." He is the I am of the Old Testament. He is God, the creator, the sustainer, the redeemer, the future and the past of the universe. Her foundation is in him. And so this morning, if you're an old hand, if you're kind of one of the crew, then what is God saying to you about how we engage with the world around us? And if you find yourself feeling that you belong a bit more to this woman's end of the spectrum, then stop listening. You don't need to listen to those narratives of rejection. You don't need to listen to those narratives of inadequacy and prejudice. You don't need to live with those narratives of failure. You don't need to hide away the things that you feel somehow or other God can't deal with. Because Jesus shows us in his encounter with this woman that there's room for you. Let's pray. Living God, we thank you that you are the Good Shepherd. We thank you that there are these unchanging truths about you that inspire and encourage us. But we thank you too that these realities are not confined to words alone, but that you lived out these truths And you continue to live out these truths through us, your people. And so forgive us. Forgive us if we, like those disciples, have become so involved in organising what we think you need that we've somehow diminished our capacity to engage with what you're actually doing. Help us if we find ourselves confused and asking questions, to be those who simply engage in your name. And for those of us who perhaps consider ourselves this morning to be almost not worthy of that kind of reality, inspire us afresh through the story of your encounter with this woman. Inspire us again, or inspire us for the first time, to believe that we can place our lives into your safe hands. I can't remember the exact words, but in one of our opening songs of worship, one of the phrases that particularly caught my heart was, I think it was either all-seeing or all-knowing, or where nothing is hidden. And I sensed at that moment that God has a particular word for some of us this morning in that. Some of us have come here today hurting, bruised, perhaps feeling a bit like that woman. And I believe God would just say to us like a loving parent, I know, I've seen. And would want us to draw strength from that. And I sense others of us have come this morning, but we don't feel we can quite engage with all of this because we just ain't good enough. There's stuff we just can't talk about. There are skeletons in the cupboard. There are mistakes. There are struggles. There are even failures that we're grappling with in the here and now. And God says, I know. I can see. But you're still welcome. And I'm a God of forgiveness and mercy and renewal. And I believe that God invites us to respond to him this morning. In Jesus' name. Amen.